From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 2013, the Supreme Court ruled the Federal Defense of Marriage Act of traditional marriage unconstitutional, but chose not to rule on whether or not there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. This year, that may change. The court may, in effect, rule on making same-sex marriage legal across the nation, or stop the gay marriage juggernaut in its tracks. Currently, 36 states plus the District of Columbia have legalized same-sex marriage, three times the number of states that allowed it when DOMA was overturned less than 2 years ago. This hour on Point, what next for gay marriage? We'll look at the constitutional arguments likely to be made before the Supreme Court. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time for a 50-state solution? One big national ruling, up or down? How would you argue this before the High Court? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. David Savage, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
I want to dive into these cases and really look at the arguments that are likely to be heard before the court. But just give us a sense first, David, if you could. We'll get to the cases. But the range of outcomes here, is there an outcome that would automatically or inexorably make gay marriage, same-sex marriage, legal in all 50 states? And what about at the other end of the spectrum of potential outcomes? Is there an outcome that could stop it or turn it back? If so, how far?
Well, yes. The first one, they could simply say that marriage is a fundamental right of all persons and that the government may not discriminate against same-sex couples. And if the court were to say that, constitutional right, no discrimination, it would mean, as you said, sort of it would be a 50-state solution. It would be gay marriage nationwide. And I think a lot of people think that's probably the most likely result. There's another middle possibility. Some of these cases involve the question of recognition. Mm-hmm. Suppose someone gets married in New York or California and moves to another state like Ohio or Indiana that didn't have gay marriage.
Right.
Would Ohio or Indiana have to recognize that marriage? So a middle position would be the court would say, yes, you have to, all states must recognize legal marriages, but they don't have to allow gay marriages themselves. And then there's the third and I think most unlikely possibility is that the court would simply say, no, there is no right to same-sex marriage. We'll allow this to be decided by the political system, but there's no constitutional right involved.
If they came to that last decision, what would that likely mean for the 36 states that have already made gay marriage legal, either through public action or court decision?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't think there's any answer to that. Because federal judges around the country have said there is a constitutional right, and in the fall, the Supreme Court refused to review a lot of those cases. So I think those of us who follow the court seem to think, well, that's a signal that suggests they're going to, at some point, uphold the right to gay marriage because, as your question suggests, on the one hand, federal judges sort of said there is a right to marry gay couples who have gone and married, and then the Supreme Court would turn around and say, no, there isn't. It would create a giant mess in all those states.
Is there any scenario where it would be reversed in some of these states where a lot of marriages have already taken place? And if so, what would the status of those marriages be?
I suppose there's a scenario where the court could say there is no right to gay marriage. But even in those cases, I think everybody has sort of accepted, and I think the courts, this has come up a few times, is that once a couple is legally married, they don't become unmarried. So even if the court were to say, no, gay marriage is not a constitutional right, they wouldn't go back and unravel marriages that have already taken place.
We're going to get into the arguments here, David, and I'm so glad you're with us. But take us into these four cases, first of all. They're all like, these are out of Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee. They're all appeals of this ruling last fall from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which upheld same-sex marriage bans in those four states.
Yes, the truth of the matter is, Tom, they're closer to being one case. In fact, the court's going to actually argue them. They said they're going to be consolidated because, as you just said, all four states had laws that either forbid or limit gay marriages. And the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati, sort of breaking with the consensus, said all those laws are constitutional. So four sides appealed, and so the court said, we'll take all four cases. But it's one case. It's one case that questions, is there a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry? And I actually don't think, in the end, the different fact patterns, the different couples will – the court will not pay a lot of attention to that, and it won't determine the outcome.
Now, on the other hand, they declined to hear appeals from states where circuit courts had struck down bans on same-sex marriage. That's been more the trend than what we saw out of the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati, right?
Yes, that's right. To go back 2 years, the Windsor case where
DOMA.
The court struck down DOMA and said, that the federal government has to provide equal benefits for legally married gay couples. That was sort of a – if you just read what the court said, that was sort of a tentative decision. It had sort of a states' rights flavor to it. But afterward, almost every federal judge who then had a case involving gay couples read that decision and struck down the bans on gay marriage. And I think the reason is that the defenders of these laws have sort of run out of reasons as to say why, if you have a committed, loving gay couple in front of you as a judge, and suppose they're raising children, what's the state's argument for saying, no, you may not be married? And one judge after another said, this is an irrational discrimination. There is no basis for denying marriage to these couples. So one judge after another says that. Several courts of appeals upheld that. All these laws are being struck down. As you said, it's now up to 36 states that allow gay marriage. And one federal appeals court went the other way. So the Supreme Court was then forced to take up the question because the Constitution can't mean one thing in one part of the country and something different in a different part of the country. But the logic of all the cases over the last 2 years has said there is a right here. There are loving couples who want to be married, and the government has no convincing reason for saying you may not marry.
I want to dig in on the arguments that what will be heard here are likely to be made. Take us to how the court is likely to break down on this. It will be a very familiar breakdown, but walk us through it, David.
Well, there are four liberal justices, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Breyer, and Kagan, who are seen as likely supporters of gay marriage. There are four conservatives, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito, who we all think would be the most skeptical. And Justice Kennedy, of course, as you know, anybody who covers the court, he's always the most interesting one because he's a conservative, a Catholic, a Reagan appointee, but he's also a California Republican. I've covered him for a long time, and he's always been different, very different than, say, Justice Scalia. He grew up in Sacramento. He practiced law. He was on a court in San Francisco. He knew gays and gay couples from many, many years ago. He never had the sense that discrimination against them was the right thing. He always thought the decisions that, even in the 1980s, that upheld the sodomy laws, he thought they were wrong. He's written opinions that says the government cannot demean loving gay couples. They deserve dignity and respect. So even though Justice Kennedy is a conservative on a whole lot of issues, he's always seen as be much more likely to join with the four liberal justices on this issue.
And what about the Chief Justice, John Roberts?
Well, I think he's going to be one of the interesting ones to watch in this case because I think Chief Justice Roberts knows where this issue is going, how this is going to come out. But I must say, during the argument 2 years ago, he seemed very skeptical of the idea that there was any sort of right to gay marriage. So I don't know whether he's going to be one interesting to watch, but his vote will not be crucial to the outcome.
Here's some of that skepticism. You can hear him. This is back in March 2013, hearing oral arguments before the Supreme Court on California's ban on same-sex marriage. That was Prop 8. And Theodore Olson, the lawyer arguing against the ban, and Chief Justice Roberts go back and forth over whether they're trying to change the definition of marriage.
So it's just about the label in this case.
The label is like —
same-sex couples have every other right. It's just about the label.
The label marriage means something, even our opponents.
Sure. If you tell a child that somebody has to be their friend, I suppose you can force the child to say, this is my friend, but it changes the definition of what it means to be a friend. And that's, it seems to me, what the supporters of Proposition 8 are saying here. All you're interested in is the label, and you insist on changing the definition of the label.
It is like you were to say you can vote, you can travel, but you may not be a citizen. There are certain labels in this country that are very, very critical.
Theodore Olson right there at the end. Chief Justice Roberts, you hear him saying, wow, you can tell a kid that someone's his friend even if he's not. That changes the definition of what it means to be a friend. Does it matter that the Chief Justice suggests by that, I guess, that advocates here are trying to change the meaning of marriage? Does that mean it's wrong or a bad idea?
Well, I don't think it'll have a big effect on Justice Kennedy. I do think – I remember that argument, and I went into it thinking that that John Roberts might be in the middle on this, mm-hmm. but he certainly sounded then and ever since then as somebody who's strongly opposed to, as he said, changing the definition of marriage. But again, I don't think in this case his view of it will be decisive.
There's speculation that if Justice Kennedy goes for gay marriage, Justice Roberts might join him so as not to have another one of these 5-4 opinions which make the court look so closely divided.
Yes, I've written things like that before, but I think on this one, we will know more, of course, on the day of the argument in April. But John Roberts did not seem like he was ready to go along with changing, opening up the way for gay marriage.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about same-sex marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court and the arguments, constitutional arguments, that may determine whether it is made the law of the land, the whole country, or get stopped, even potentially turned back. Earlier this month here, it was in Miami, the judge lifting there the stay on same-sex marriage in Miami-Dade County Courtroom, January 5th.
I'm lifting the stay.
There has been a lot of that sound around the country. It came up in the President Obama's State of the Union speech this week.
I've seen something like gay marriage go from a wedge issue used to drive us apart to a story of freedom across our country, a civil right now legal in states that 7 in 10 Americans call home.
Mary Bonato argued the case before the Massachusetts Supreme Court back in 2003, landmark decision, first in the country to legalize same-sex marriage. Here she is talking about the constitutional aspect before the American Constitution Society last July.
The framers of our Constitution were not setting forth a rule book. They were setting forth enduring principles that would guide our country for centuries more. And so it's essential that courts and judges bring to that task of judging a real sense, a modern sense of what does liberty, what does equality mean in present times.
A modern sense of what liberty and equality mean in present times, and many are saying the court may make that the law of the land by this summer. Not everyone wants to see it decided there. Brian Brown, president of the National Organization for Marriage, argued on C-SPAN last fall, courts don't always reflect the wishes of the voters.
The courts are making these decisions, not the American people. There have only been 3 votes where states have voted to redefine marriage. All the rest, 32 states, voted to protect marriage as the union of a man and a woman.
But many are saying, Republicans now, party insiders saying, well, it might be convenient if this were decided by the court. It's become quite widely accepted among the populace, and that would take it a little out of the political arena where it's become something of a problem for the GOP. We want to look at the arguments around this, likely to be heard before the court. Joining me now from Chicago is Camilla Taylor, Marriage Project Director at the gay rights group Lambda Legal. She was lead counsel in their marriage equality lawsuit in Iowa, struck down Iowa's gay marriage ban in 2009. Professor at Northwestern University School of Law, serves on the American Constitution Society's Chicago Board of Advisors. Camilla Taylor, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And with us from Minneapolis is Teresa Collette. She's professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. In 2009, she was appointed to the Pontifical Council for the Family by Pope Benedict, a post that's been extended by Pope Francis. Teresa Collette, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be here again. Thank you.
Great to have you. David Savage is with us from the Los Angeles Times, and he's kind of set the table for us. Camilla, dive in. You're before the high court. The way is open here. What's the strongest constitutional argument you're ready to make for them to go your way on gay marriage? Pro.
Well, we've made two main arguments in all of the cases around the country in which we've sought the freedom to marry. First, that it violates the fundamental right to marry to deprive same-sex couples and their children of the shelter of marriage. And second, that it discriminates unconstitutionally if you target same-sex couples and their children and deprive them of access to marriage. And so far, two federal circuit courts of appeals have ruled on the fundamental right to marry ground, that it violates the Constitution to fence these families out of marriage. And two circuit courts of appeals have agreed with us on the equal protection ground. So they're both extremely strong arguments. They both are arguments that resonate a great deal in Windsor, which found that the federal law that deprived marriages of same-sex couples of federal recognition deprived these families of equal dignity. And that decision ruled on both equal protection and due process grounds. So I think we're likely to see something that's very similar in these cases, the Sixth Circuit case is up before the court now.
We'll get into the nuance of those arguments. Teresa Collette argued from the other side. Your fundamental argument, if you were standing before the court against them making this a 50-state reality by judicial interpretation.
Well, let me go back to the way the quote table was set, because as Brian Brown made the point, the people, when given the opportunity to make a responsible decision on this question, have consistently said that we want to retain the historical definition of marriage. So the idea that there's this juggernaut that's being moved by a change in popular opinion is simply not true.
Well, you can see it in popularity in opinion polls. That's what I meant by juggernaut
opinion
to the extent that
matter. What matters is how we vote at the ballots. There have been plenty of elections where the polls have told us something different than what the people tell us.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a country run by opinion polls. We're a country run that is supposed to be a democratic republic. In this case, what's happening is federal courts are forcing their own individual opinion about this on the people. And as was noted at the closing of the opening remarks by the journalist, this creates a real problem because they are changing the law without the people having an opportunity to express their will. I think it's fascinating that we're having this conversation on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, another time when the court took upon itself the opportunity to make a political decision in the guise of judicial constitutional interpretation.
So duly noted, we put a big bookmark in here of your objection to this being decided in the courts at all, but in the Constitution of our Republic also does have a role for the courts. They have, as you say, even with Roe v. Wade and much more, they've played very big roles in the past. It is before the Supreme Court now. So that's the arena it's in. How would you argue this case?
I would argue it the exact way Judge Sutton ruled in the Sixth Circuit, which is that it shouldn't be in the courts, that in fact this is a question that should be left to the people, that in Windsor the court expressly said that it is a question to be decided on a state-by-state basis, and where a state makes a decision, the federal government must respect it. In the same way, it's a question to be decided on a state-by-state basis, and when a state makes a decision, the federal courts must respect it. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution or the history and traditions of our people that say that the federal government, when acting through the Congress, has to respect states' rights, but yet when the courts have some freedom to disregard those states' rights that they themselves have articulated as recently just a couple years ago.
Let's look at that first. There was an exchange, again, back in March 2013. This was between Chief Justice John Roberts and Robert Kaplan, representing plaintiff Edith Windsor in that U.S. versus Windsor case that eventually overturned DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. And here the Chief Justice is suggesting that what was going on was a result of a political power shift. Ms. Kaplan rejected that view. You'll hear Roberts first, then Kaplan.
You don't doubt that the lobby supporting the enactment of same-sex marriage laws in different states is politically powerful, do you?
With respect to that category, that categorization of the term for purposes of heightened scrutiny, I would, Your Honor. I don't.
Really?
Yes.
As far as I can tell, political figures are falling over themselves to endorse your side of the case.
The fact of the matter is, Mr. Chief Justice, is that no other group in recent history has been subjected to popular referenda to take away rights that have already been given or exclude those rights the way gay people have.
David Savage, come in here for a moment. It is interesting. I mean, since 2013, this has moved very strongly into the courts clearing the way for gay marriage. What about the argument that it shouldn't be before the courts or the high court in particular at all here? Could that argument have any sway once the court is actually taking this up? Is it moot?
Well, I think it's had sway, Tom, because I remember talking about this subject with you 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the liberal justices were very glad to have this sort of move, sort of in a wave across the country, that they were very sensitive to the Roe versus Wade issue, that they did not want to be out ahead of the country and forcing a major change in the law. But as we've said, there's public opinion has shifted dramatically on this issue, that 55-60% of the public is in favor of gay marriage, and now one judge after another. So now that the issue comes back in 2015, where, as Barack Obama said, gay marriage is legal for 7 in 10 percent of the public nationwide, and most of the big states, the Supreme Court would no longer be in the situation of forcing a dramatic change throughout the country. I actually think the most powerful argument is a sort of historical analogy that will come up in the briefs, and it's the issue of interracial marriage in the Loving versus Virginia case. In 1954, the Supreme Court struck down racial segregation in the schools, and they chose not to rule at that time and the years after on the marriage issue. They waited till 1967, 13 years later, they issued a unanimous opinion in a case called nicely called Loving versus Virginia, where Earl Warren said marriage is a fundamental liberty, and there is no justification for denying marriage to interracial couples. And I think the same, I think for Justice Kennedy and the liberal justices, that's what's going on here, that it would have been a problem 10 years ago for the court to say there's a right to same-sex marriage. It would have struck people as going too far too fast. Now, I think most of the country has accepted gay marriage, and so it's a much easier for the court to say now we say there's a fundamental right for gay couples to marry, and there's no justification for discriminating against them.
Teresa Collette, I want to bring this fundamental right argument to you and get your response. Let me get a call here first from lots of callers, but let's go to Enterprise, Alabama. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my comment would be, you know, earlier we were talking about a Chief Justice that said that it was just about the label of marriage and changing the label. Mm. And one thing that I believe is that, you know, it's this idea of not being able to have the label of marriage is kind of this view of like a separate but equal. Like you can have all these rights, but it's separate from the rights of married people, but it's similar. And it didn't work in the civil rights movement, and why they think it would work now is kind of confusing to me. So that's just all I wanted to comment on.
Peter, I appreciate your call. Teresa Collette, what about it? The parallel being made here to the civil rights movement, to the history of African Americans, enslavement, and all the rest in this country. Electorates have been willing in American history to trample on the rights of others in this country. You heard Roberta Kaplan there saying that no other group in recent history has been subjected to popular referenda to take away rights. What about that argument, Professor Collette?
Well, in fact, probably the more apt analogy is the Dred Scott case, in which the United States Supreme Court refused to allow the states to make individual determinations about the institution of slavery. As Judge Sutton said in his Sixth Circuit opinion, the case of Loving versus Virginia was not about redefining marriage. There was no question that across the world and historically, marriage had been the union of a man and a woman. It was about a racial exclusion that was not found throughout the country as a general rule. In fact, states had, through their own political process, been removing those bans, and they hadn't been present in all the states. That's not the case in marriage. Those bans were based on animus and a disregard of black people, whereas the definition of marriage that was consistent throughout this country, all 50 states, has not been based on any desire to harm people who have same-sex desires. Rather, it was based on the state's recognition that that union that creates new life and that undertakes the responsibility of nurturing that child all the way to adulthood is unique and entitled to state protection and state encouragement.
What about the argument we heard from Mary Bonato there with GLAD? This was in the Massachusetts case, but she was making it later, saying it's essential that courts and judges bring to the task of judging a real sense, a modern sense of what does liberty, what does equality mean in present times? Professor Collette.
Well, that idea that we have this evolving constitution that means whatever the justices thinks it means sort of usurps the whole right of the people to make their own determination. When we talk about the advances that we've seen in civil rights, the most important advance in civil rights was when Congress passed the Civil Rights Act itself. The courts themselves are very blunt instruments. What they do is they deny us the right to participate politically. And that, in many ways, is our most precious political right, the right to, as a community, be self-determining. And when they write into the Constitution things that are not apparent there, either in the text or the history and traditions of our people, they go far beyond the constitutional order and, in fact, threaten the very freedoms that we love.
Camilla Taylor, what about these arguments? Should it not be decided in the courts in the first place? And to call same-sex marriage a fundamental right stretches the Constitution too far.
Well, there's a reason why decisions about whether slavery should continue to exist or whether states should be able to ban members of different races from marrying each other. There's a reason why these questions should not be left up to the states and are not left up to the states. And that reason is the Equal Protection and Due Process Clause in the Constitution of the United States. States are free to legislate concerning marriage, but they have to do it subject to constitutional guarantees. And that's a very basic principle. The democratic process argument, if that had held sway, that laws passed through the democratic process were somehow shielded from constitutional review, then there would still be laws banning members of different races from marrying. Women would be excluded from places of higher learning that are state-funded and state-run, the world would look very different in this country. But that is simply not our law. Our law recognizes that those who adopted the Bill of Rights had a long-term vision. They understood that we would have what Windsor termed an evolving understanding of equality. That's the majority opinion in Windsor. And Lawrence has another quote. Lawrence versus Texas was the 2003 case that struck down laws that criminalized intimacy between members of the same sex across the country. And in Lawrence, the court acknowledged that laws once thought necessary and proper may in fact serve only to oppress, and that we can have a growing understanding as a country and as a society about what is appropriate and acceptable and what violates the fundamental guarantees of liberty and equality in the Constitution. And one more thing about the analogy that David mentioned to Loving versus Virginia in 1967.
Interracial marriage. Mm-hmm.
That's right. At the time that Loving versus Virginia was decided, there were only 16 states in the country that still prohibited members of different races from marrying. And at the time that Lawrence versus Texas was decided, there were still only 13 states in the country that prohibited, that criminalized people for being lesbian or gay, that prohibited intimacy between members of the same sex. Here we are with only 14 states left that prohibit lesbian and gay couples from marrying, and that, in the words of Windsor, humiliate the children of these couples by telling them that there's something wrong with their families, something of which they should be ashamed, and interfering with their ability to understand the integrity and the closeness of their own families. So we are here at a juncture in our nation's history that resembles the places we have been before when the court has stepped in order to protect individual liberties.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about same-sex marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court and the arguments, constitutional arguments, that may determine whether it is made the law of the land, the whole country, or is stopped. You can join us this hour with Teresa Collette of the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. She's pushing against a ruling in favor of same-sex marriage by the high court, arguing that side today. Camilla Taylor is a marriage project director at Lambda Legal. She argues the other way out of Chicago, pro-change here. And David Savage covers it all for the Los Angeles Times, that is, the Supreme Court. March of 2013, here was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, again, back in the U.S. versus Windsor case, saying, let's not hem in same-sex marriage to a lesser status. No two tiers of message, please. a marriage.
As Justice Kennedy said, 1,100 statutes, and it affects every area of life. And so you would be really diminishing what the state has said is marriage. You're saying, no, state, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
No full marriage versus skim milk marriage. And here's Justice Kennedy in those same arguments, asking Charles Cooper. This was the lawyer defending the ban on same-sex marriage out of, this is the California case, Prop 8 there, asking that attorney how to consider how the children of same-sex couples might be affected by the ban.
And there is an immediate legal injury or legal, what could be a legal injury, and that's the voice of these children. There are some 40,000 children in California, according to the Red Brief, that live with same-sex parents. And they want their parents to have full recognition and full status. The voice of those children is important in this case, don't you think?
Justice Kennedy, whose vote is very likely to determine which way the court goes here, whose decision. David Savage, on what basis is he likely to come in here? A fundamental right? Is Justice Kennedy prone to seeing this that way?
Yes, and well, I thought Teresa and Camilla laid out the different views of the conservative liberal view on this that'll play out in this case. So take the word liberty and equality. They were added to the Constitution after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment. Justice Scalia's view is, we know what those words meant when they were added to the Constitution, and that's essentially what they should mean today. If the voters want to go out and change the laws, fine, but we should interpret the phrase liberty and equality as it was understood in 1868. Justice Kennedy is much more of a person who thinks we should interpret those phrases in a sort of evolving way, what they mean today. Someone quoted the phrase from, you know, I've heard him talk about this in conversation and in his opinions, that even in your own life, you're frequently blind to discrimination around you. I remember him talking about, he was a student at Stanford in 1958 when Thurgood Marshall came to speak. And he said, you know, at that time, I thought all of our civil rights problems were solved because of Brown versus the Board of Education had come 4 years before, 1958. And he said, you know, in your own time, you're sort of blind to discrimination. And so Justice Kennedy has very much of the view that we should interpret liberty and equality by what they mean today. He said in Windsor, we have a new perspective, a new insight on gay couples. So I think Justice Kennedy's view is we're going to interpret the phrase, what's a right to liberty today and what's equality today based on our current understanding. And so that's why I think he's going to be on the side of voting for a right to gay marriage.
Megan in Boston, thank you for calling, Megan. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was just curious about the maybe like church and state issue, because I think that marriage is a religious passage, no matter what your religion is, and a lot of religions, and having it decided by the court, how would that impact that? I mean,
leave it to religious organizations. In other words, keep it out of the secular decision.
Could it really be enforced across the board in those groups, I guess, is
Megan, let us pick it up. Camilla Taylor, church, state, sort of court and government, stay out of this. This is fundamentally a religious question.
Sure. Well, if you wish to have a religious ceremony when you marry, of course, you can do that. And the Constitution, of course, protects all of us in making our own religious choices. And no law could prevent any religious denomination from determining for itself whom it will marry. The question here is civil marriage. States license marriages. That's been true since the very beginning of our country, and there are historical reasons for that. I mean, the Pilgrims came over here in part because the Church of England controlled who may marry, and they set it up in this country so that it would be a civil ceremony, or a civil institution, rather, and states would have control over licenses, and that it would not be determined based on your religion who may marry and who may not. So these cases will not have any impact on which religions choose to marry same-sex couples. And, of course, government could never dictate to religious institutions or organizations that they must do so. It's simply about who may obtain a license from the state and be recognized under state and federal law as married and receive all of the protections, the responsibilities, the benefits, hundreds under state law, and, as Justice Ginsburg just mentioned, 1,100 or so under the federal law, the federal system as well.
Jennifer in Dayton, Ohio. Jennifer, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually have a similar point to what was just made. I have two main arguments that bother me. As a member of the LGBT community, the people that are making arguments against gay marriage many times are making a religious argument. And in this country, we are supposed to have a separation between church and state, which should mean that the religious tenets of a belief system I don't practice should not be used to determine what civil rights that I have as an American. And the other main argument that I would make is we also have a provision for equal protection under the law. And as we just said, there are over 1,100 or 1,200 different privileges, rights, and protections that come when you get a marriage license. That's what gay couples are fighting for. It's not getting married in a church in a white dress. It's the civil contract that marriage offers.
Jennifer, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. David Savage, the court could decide this on any number of grounds. I'm curious what you see the strongest or weakest being. I'm reading Dale Carpenter in the Washington Post saying ruling on in terms of fundamental right might be the weakest. He says the strongest would be if the court rules on the basis of sexual orientation discrimination. How would that go? Why would that be a strong way for the pro-same-sex marriage position?
Well, I think a lot of the advocates would like the court to say, which is something they've not said before, which is that any government discrimination based on sexual orientation is unconstitutional. Many years ago, the 70s and 80s, the court would frequently go through these gyrations where they'd say racial discrimination is unconstitutional in any, and we're going to impose strict scrutiny. And then in the 70s and 80s, they said that about gender. And the court hasn't exactly said that in any case involving gays. They haven't said all discrimination of any sort for any reason is unconstitutional. But I actually think the current justices, Kennedy among them, are inclined to write an opinion that says this type of discrimination in this case is irrational and it can't stand. So I don't think they'll write the kind of opinion that Dale Carpenter would say would like and that would go further and, you know, for example, have an impact in all kinds of other areas. But I do think they're inclined to write a strong opinion that says marriage is a matter of fundamental liberty in this country, and there's no justification under the Equal Protection Clause from denying it to gay couples.
Camilla Taylor, if you got a decision in favor of same-sex marriage based on an argument that any discrimination based on sexual orientation was unconstitutional, what would the implications of that be beyond marriage?
Well, I'm not sure a decision would say that just because the Equal Protection Clause doesn't say in any context that any form of discrimination is unconstitutional. But it gives us a framework in which we can analyze discrimination claims. And what it does with respect to race or with respect to sex is it deprives the laws that classify on those bases of a presumption of constitutionality. So it puts the burden on government to come up with some sort of particularly compelling or important justification for why those laws should stand. And I think that the Supreme Court has already made clear in the context of laws targeting lesbian and gay people for discrimination that those laws do not enjoy a presumption of constitutionality, that government does have to justify why those laws were passed and what the reason is for them. And the court has identified in two cases now, if not three, that the purpose of targeting lesbian and gay couples to fence them out of some sort of protection or benefit that other people can receive is itself an impermissible purpose. It's not an acceptable reason to pass a law. And it's also unacceptable to pass a law simply to say that you disapprove of a group of people. I actually think that one of the strongest ways that we could receive a victory in these new marriage cases from the Sixth Circuit is for the court to do what it did in Windsor, which is to say it deprives lesbian and gay people of equal liberty to deprive them of marriage. Because ultimately, what Windsor was about and what these cases are about is recognition of our common humanity and our common right to equal dignity in the eyes of our community.
Would that kind of decision have implications beyond marriage and employment discrimination and housing discrimination for same-sex couples or individuals?
Absolutely, because the framework that the court applies makes clear that classifications that target all of us for our sexual orientation, whether we are gay or non-gay, are presumptively unconstitutional, that the courts can't accept any sort of conceivable basis that the state might come up with after the fact to justify these laws. But it has to scrutinize these laws more carefully. The court in Windsor described its process as using careful consideration when it sees laws targeting lesbian and gay people for exclusion. And I think that that makes clear that government has to say something different from simply, we don't want this group of people to be able to share in what other people have.
Teresa Collette, how would you look at an equal liberty argument? And what about the court looking at this and saying that exclusion of gay couples from marriage rests on animus and deciding that way?
Well, so let me answer that as well as the other six exchanges that I haven't had a chance to comment on. I think that it's quite clear there is nothing in the history of the adoption of our basic definition of marriage in this country from colonial times forward that evidences animus. The fact that the states were unanimous in their definition had nothing to do with their view about homosexuality and everything to do with their view about the fact that children do best when they have both their mother and their father, their biological mother and father, living in the same home and nurturing them and guiding them.
Saying there was no animus in our culture and law toward homosexuals in our history?
That is not what I said. What I said is there's no evidence in history when the basic definitions of marriage were passed, when states became states in the 1800s, that it was about animus about gays.
Okay.
It was about creating the best environment for children to come into the world and be raised. And that argument has never been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court. I agree that the court has always said where you can show that there's something unique and irrational about the law, that in that instance, we will strike it down. But remember, in the case of Lawrence v. Texas regarding the sodomy law, the court said that there was no justification. Either the action was wrong for both heterosexuals and homosexuals, or it was wrong for nobody. And so they saw in that distinction something that they found to be irrational. So I don't think the animus argument's going to get us there. As far as religion, we're already seeing the impact on religion. We are seeing churches being, arguments being made they should lose their tax-exempt status for the properties they own because they will not afford access for same-sex ceremonies. We are seeing a church recently attacked because they declined to bury someone because it was outside of the norms of the church. There is no question that the state can exercise control over religion. All we have to think about is the fact that the Little Sisters of the Poor will be in front of the United States Supreme Court defending their right not to provide contraception to the nuns.
Equal liberty doesn't cut it for you then.
The question is equal liberty to do what? We have a case on polygamy coming out of Utah where a court found that if all it is based on the affection and mutual care of adults, if that's all marriage is about, then why shouldn't the polygamy laws in Utah, New Mexico, Oklahoma fall as well?
Do you anticipate at this point, given what you know of the High Court, which is a lot, and Justice Kennedy, do you think it's going to go pro same-sex marriage, 50-state solution, Professor Collette?
What I think is Justice Kennedy's language in Windsor about the importance of the political process and leaving it to the states to work these divisive issues out is dramatically different than the language he used in Casey, where he said that the court was called to bring the competing visions of the nation to a common end. And so I think he learned his lesson, and I think he is actually going to be very cautious about imposing a definition. You keep saying that it's going to bring it to a screeching halt, this change of definition, but the reality is all that's going to be brought to a screeching halt is judicial interference in the political process. Gays and lesbians won the vote in my state of Minnesota when they defeated the marriage amendment, and then we statutorily redefined it through the democratic process. That's the way it should work if it's going to happen.
David Savage, how do you think this is going to go?
Well, the true answer is I don't know. But I think the likelihood is that Justice Kennedy is going to be on the side of a right to gay marriage.
And if that happens, Camilla Taylor, do you see 50 states having it legal within some time frame, like what?
Hopefully by early July.
Just a done deal, the court's decision, and that would be it?
I think there's a reason for the giddy optimism that you're seeing among the LGBT community around the country, and I share it.
Camilla Taylor with Lambda Legal out of Chicago. Thank you for joining us, Camilla.
Thank you so much for having me.
Teresa Collette at the University of St. Thomas. Teresa, thank you for being here.
Glad to be included.
And David Savage at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.